This is the Breaker.News podcast for the 26th of November, 2017. Welcome. I am Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues and institutions. Help stop the secrecy and unravel the spin. Later, I'll tell you how you can support The Breaker. On this episode, regular features such as the Is It Just Me? Commentary, Around the Rim, headlines from Guam, China, and San Francisco, Cascadia Calling, headlines from BC and Washington, The Big Deal feature, which is a look back at the 1997 Asia-Pacific Economic Conference with law professor and civil libertarian Craig Jones, and The Breaker will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to people making a difference this week. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or is Gregor Robertson's Housing Vancouver strategy too little, too late? The mayor and his Vision Vancouver party won control of city council for the first time some 3,300 days ago in the fall of 2008. The top platform promise on page 3 was under the heading Homelessness and Affordable Housing. The left-wing party audaciously promised to end street homelessness by 2015 and to make living in Vancouver more affordable. 2015 came and went. There are now more than 3,600 people living on streets, in tents, and at emergency shelters around Metro Vancouver. In 2016, the rental vacancy rate fell to 0.7%, and a one-bedroom apartment will cost $1,200 a month. The average sale price for a house is $1.8 million, double what it was in 2008. That's thanks to billions of dollars invested by mainland Chinese after decisions made by Vision Vancouver. Now, with more than 300 days to go until the 2018 civic election, Robertson says he has a goal of 72,000 new homes in Vancouver over the next 10 years. This after failing to deliver on marquee housing promises during his first 9 years in power because he kowtowed to big money donors from real estate and construction companies. Make no mistake, this new plan is not really about housing Vancouverites now or in 10 years. It's about keeping the mayor comfortable in his West End penthouse and keeping the party he leads warm, dry, and powerful inside the 1936 Heritage Tower at 12th and Cambie, otherwise known as City Hall. Now is the time on the Breaker.News podcast where we go around the rim, when we look at the news headlines around the Pacific Rim. First, Frank Tang in the South China Morning Post in Hong Kong reports that the good times may be over for overseas shopping agents as China cuts import tariffs. Analysts say that the once flourishing overseas shopping agents, or Daigo, could start to feel the pinch of China's new round of import tariff cuts. Taxes on food, health supplements, pharmaceuticals, clothing, and recreational products will be slashed from 17.3% to 7.7% next month. Tariffs on some special infant milk formulas, a product highly sought after by mainland Chinese following the death of young children in a tainted milk scandal in 2008, have been cut to zero from 20%. Beijing is also encouraging people to spend more at home in its bid to transform the economy to a consumption-driven one. Last year, 42 million Chinese spent $280 billion on buying foreign products through e-commerce. Radiation Survivors to Meet reports John Boria in Guam's Pacific Daily News. Groups continue to press the local and U.S. governments for compensation of Guam residents who were exposed to radiation from nuclear testing in the Marshall Islands from the mid-1940s to the early 1960s. The Pacific Association for Radiation Survivors holds its annual general membership meeting to provide an update on its efforts to include Guam in the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act. Specifically, the association will discuss recent successes towards its cause. Nearly 200 atmospheric nuclear tests were conducted between 1945 and 1962. Currently, the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act applies to U.S. states that had uranium miners, millers, and ore transporters, areas where nuclear tests were conducted, and downwinders of the Nevada test site. Guam is about 1,300 miles from the Marshall Islands, but a 2005 report from the National Research Council concluded that Guam was downwind of the nuclear fallout and therefore affected. The council recommended that Guam be included in the compensation program. Curtis Alexander reports in the San Francisco Chronicle that multi-billion dollar water measures are heading to the state ballot. A five-year drought and then a winter of floods exposed the limits of California's vast network of reservoirs, dams, and canals. Voters are likely to have the chance in 2018 to decide whether to pay for major upgrades to the state's waterworks. Two multi-billion dollar bonds are expected to go before voters that promise to boost water supplies, offer flood protection, and restore rivers and streams. One measure, sponsored by the legislature, also would fund new parks and hiking trails. The second, a privately backed initiative, would go further to improve the infrastructure that moves water to cities and farms. The near failure of the Oroville Dam last winter and drought-induced water shortages are still fresh in voters' minds, so now is the time to go to the public to fund long-term improvements. But, with two measures likely to add a combined $14 billion plus to the state's bond debt, some skeptics say the would-be water overhaul is an overreach. That's Around the Rim for this week. It's time for Cascadia Calling on the Breaker.News podcast when we look at news headlines from around the Pacific Northwest. Dirk Meisner of the Canadian Press reported on Washington Governor Jay Inslee's visit to the legislature in Victoria. Inslee was the first governor from Washington to address the legislature since 1984. He also held meetings with BC Premier John Horgan. In his speech, Inslee focused on fighting climate change and building stronger economic ties with BC. He said people living on both sides of the border do not want to see rivers without wild salmon or the Salish Sea without orcas. Inslee's speech did not mention the Trans Mountain Pipeline expansion, which will increase oil tanker traffic on the West Coast. Prime Minister Justin Trudeau approved the project between Alberta and BC about a year ago. With more crude oil expected to move through waters shared by Washington State and Canada, Democratic lawmakers in the state introduced a bill to raise more money for spill prevention and response efforts. Inslee said he wants improved transportation links between Washington and BC, including a high-speed rail route. Canada's Pacific region and the U.S. West Coast represent an economic, technological, and environmental powerhouse, which could become the third largest economy in the world, said Inslee. Check TV in Victoria reports that the ENN Railway Working Group promise has been canned. Last winter, the former BC Liberal government promised a working group would tackle options to build a commuter link along the ENN railway corridor. Now, the NDP is in power and the promise is on hold. Transportation Minister Clara Trevena defended the decision. She said, "What the previous government did was short-sighted, just ahead of the last election, obviously trying to win them brownie points. What we want to do is make sure we get something viable for the ENN, including the participation of all the stakeholders," Trevena said. But the need for a solution is clear, as the West Shore continues to expand the daily gridlock passing through the city, and it's only getting worse. And finally, the Tacoma News Tribune's Kenny Ocker reports that a naked, drunken man wrecks car into tree while having sex with passenger, State Patrol says. Well, when a man loves a woman, and a woman loves a man, wait. Let me tell you about the birds and the bees and the cars in the trees. A drunken man was driving on State Route 7 near La Grande, naked and having sex with the also-naked woman, who was supposed to be in the passenger seat, when he missed a curve, went off Mountain Highway, and struck a tree, State Patrol spokeswoman Brooke Bova said. She was hospitalized with broken bones, and her three-month-old child in the backseat was uninjured, Bova said. The man was arrested and taken to Pierce County Jail on suspicion of felony driving under the influence, vehicular assault, and child endangerment, Bova said. He has three prior DUI convictions. That's Cascadia Calling for this week. On the Big Deal this week. It was November 25th, 1997. The University of British Columbia campus on Point Grey in Vancouver was teeming with police. Prime Minister Jean Chrétien hosted 18 leaders at the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit. The eyes of the world were on Vancouver, and students were not happy to welcome Indonesian dictator Suharto or Chinese President Jiang Zemin to their campus. It was only 8 years since the Chinese government cracked down on student protests in Tiananmen Square, while the world was watching in shock. More than 2,500 people protested, and many were pepper-sprayed by RCMP officers. Police made 48 arrests. You may remember this arrogant and ignorant Chrétien answer to Nardwuar the Human Serviette on that day.
What do you see?
Some of the protesters were maced. Does mace equal freedom? Would you have been maced yourself back then, Prime Minister Chrétien?
But I don't know what you mean by that.
A mace? Pepper spray? Some other members
of the media? Oh, but I don't know. This technique did not exist in those days. For me, pepper, I put it on my plate. Next.
A public inquiry later found that police were under pressure from the Prime Minister's office and they violated the protesters' civil rights. One of them was law student Craig Jones, who innocently placed paper signs on security fences. Jones graduated from UBC in 1998, got a master's degree at Harvard in 2002, and worked as a constitutional lawyer in the BC government. He is a former president of the BC Civil Liberties Association. He spoke to The Breaker from Kamloops 20 years after APEC 97. Talk about that day. What was going through your mind on November 25th, 1997, when you were on campus and decided to express your opinion when leaders of the world and world media were here in Vancouver?
Me and a few of my fellow students had become concerned with the sort of police crackdown on the protesters to that point, and we had a privileged position in that we lived right beside the motorcade route, and so we just decided to erect a few signs along the route. Democracy said one, I think, free speech and human rights, fairly, I thought, innocuous statements. Anyway, when we did that, the police who were manning the sort of nearby checkpoints became very concerned and first asked us to move the signs, and we did, and then they said, well, we couldn't have them there at all, and that's when the argument ensued that ended up with me as the meat in an RCMP sandwich, and I was, I think I was the first person arrested that day. This all happened very early in the morning, and then later that day, of course, there were the much larger protests and the pepper spray incidents and the things that, were broadcast immediately on the television. And then, you know, over the period of the next few years, actually, I think it was took 4 years for the inquiry decision to come down. We fought to establish some limits on the political suppression of protests. It came out in the context of the inquiry, when all of the government documents were revealed that the Prime Minister's office had actually directed the RCMP to arrest certain students, and it was really all very unseemly, in a way kind of gratifying to participate in that process. I was quite struck by how offended Canadians seemed to be by what happened, and how willing they were to, set up a process to figure out exactly what happened and see what they could do to correct it.
Talk about how life in Canada, how life in the Pacific Rim has changed for good and bad since then, now that globalization since 1997 has accelerated. The economies are more interrelated. Yet China has really become a dominant player for the Asia-Pacific economies. It's an important trade partner. It's important for tourism here in British Columbia, especially. Yet the issues of democracy, human rights, and free speech, despite all the hopes that we had for the internet, have not fulfilled themselves. In fact, there's greater censorship now in China, and some of that is affecting
countries in the Asia Pacific that are now worried about offending China for fear of harming trade relationships?
Yeah, well, I'm no international political scientist, but I'd sort of generally agree that the idea that trade alone would somehow democratize, you know, that engagement would somehow democratize has had mixed results. And I think it all has to do with sort of relative power. You know, if you're trading with countries that aren't very powerful, you can probably bring more pressure to bear with respect to human rights and democratization and whatnot. And but when you're dealing with, you know, an emerging superpower like China, those are going to be less successful. I think you just you simply don't have the same leverage. And I think that's what we've seen, that China has leveraged its economic advantages and trade relationships to allow the regime to protect itself as opposed to opening it up. So, you know, it's obviously still a work in progress. We don't know what's going to happen with China over the next decade as it, you know, fully steps out onto the world stage. But it's been disappointing, I think, on that level.
And what would you say about freedom of speech, human rights, democracy here in Canada since 1997? We do, of course, focus on what goes on in China and other places in the world, but is it better, worse, the same for Canadians, you know, for the law students at your university, those who are now at UBC, if they were to try the same thing, do you think that they would get in worse trouble? Or do you think that those views are now respected, especially now when there are greater influences on campuses from foreign organizations and corporations?
Yeah, I do think, you know, as far as political speech goes, I think we're probably in better shape than we were 25 years ago, 20 years ago. I think there are many other and subtler threats to free speech, both on campus and elsewhere. You know, there's been a lot of controversy about events at Laurier, for instance, and that's really a different kind of issue. The internet clearly has changed everything. You know, when APEC happened, email was brand new and most people were still using DOS. So the sort of radicalization of speech on the internet has changed everything. I think, you know, all the marbles are really in the air, and where they're going to come down in the next few years is going to be awesome and fascinating and maybe frightening too.
That was Craig Jones, law professor at Thompson Rivers University. Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or organization that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to the Search and Rescue Volunteers of British Columbia. Coquitlam Search and Rescue led a mission of 89 volunteers from 19 groups to find dog walker Annette Poitras on November 22nd. She survived two cold and wet days and nights in the Coquitlam watershed. There are 80 search and rescue groups across BC with 2,500 volunteer members. More people are living in BC and visiting BC than ever, and they're enjoying the great outdoors, but some of them get lost or injured. That's when volunteer search and rescue teams are called to action. The brave men and women are underappreciated and overworked. They deserve to become a fully funded part of BC's emergency services. So, to each and every one of them, a virtual Nanaimo bar from TheBreaker.News. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for this edition of the Breaker.News podcast for November 26th, 2017. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Send me your feedback and your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Again, the email address is bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month, like Daryl Greer of Vancouver, who signed up for the $10 NewsHound supporter level. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Have a safe and happy week wherever you are.